Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming here. I'm Robert Higgs, and I've met some of you before, and to those of you I haven't met before, I'm glad to know you, and I hope to get to know you better personally after the seminar is over. I do know some of you from previous encounters, and so it's good to see old friends again. And it's kind of an adventure for me to teach because I'm not a teacher anymore. I haven't been a professor for almost 20 years, and so this kind of teaching is all I do. And one consequence of that is that I don't normally speak very much in my day-to-day life, and I don't have a strong voice. So if I start getting scratchy, you'll know why. But at all events, we're going to deal here with what you might call Austrian economic history, and I don't frequently see people refer to that specific phrase, Austrian economic history, but I think there is such a thing, different from economic history in general, that you might encounter in an ordinary university, in a graduate program particularly, but not different in every way. Just some ways. Now, let me, before I start, find out a little bit about you. How many of you are graduate students in economics? Okay, so most of you. And I know what you're studying. So if you're not a graduate student in economics, would you tell me what you are studying?
History.
Graduate student in history? And
political economy, graduate student.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyone else? Not a grad student in economics? Okay, well, that's good. I like to know a little bit about what your background may be. Let's just take a minute to recall some of the distinctions that are made by Austrian writers and researchers between economics or economic theory and economic history. You've all, I'm sure, done a certain amount of reading by Austrian authors, or you wouldn't be here. And in the course of doing that reading, you've probably noticed that some Austrians talk a lot about historical matters. Maybe they're the history of what happened yesterday or last week, or sometimes it's the history of things that happened long ago. But lots of Austrians talk about history, and many of the greatest Austrian economists were also preeminent historians. That's certainly true of Mises himself, of Hayek as well, and Rothbard, and many lesser lights as well. They wrote a great deal about economic history as well as about pure theory, which the Austrians usually call praxeology, which is the general science of human action, of choice, and just the pure logic of it, apart from anything empirical other than the action axiom, which is, in one way or another, an empirical matter. This is one of the odd things. It's very difficult to grasp about Austrian economics because it's not simply the pure logic of choice built on nothing but tautologies. The action axiom has empirical content, and the content it had was sort of explained differently by Mises and by Rothbard, but not in a way that Rothbard considered important. He was willing to go ahead and simply consider the action axiom as an empirically relevant observation on which we could build the logic of choice. Mises himself had a kind of Kantian philosophical view of the nature of the action axiom, but nonetheless, it was not strictly a tautology or a raw definition. It had connection with the empirical world. So in theory and praxeology, we're dealing with logical relationships built on the action axiom, and we don't really need to go out and be taking observations of the world around us or making measurements of anything as we do so. Now, we develop that theoretical apparatus, and then we use it to interpret observations of empirical reality. Now, this is where a distinction comes up in a very important way between economic history as practiced by the Austrians and economic history as practiced by mainstream economic historians, particularly those trained in economics. And in the United States, most of the people who teach economic history now are economists. This is usually a subject taught in economics departments rather than history departments. About 40 years ago, the historians gave up on it and allowed the economists to take charge, because at that time there was a kind of revolution going on in economic history, the so-called cleometric revolution, or new economic history, it was called in the late 50s and 60s when I came into the profession. And I was trained in a completely mainstream university and department, and so I was taught to think of economic history as basically just another field of applied economics to be done the same way all other fields of applied economics were conducted, which is to say we used economic theory as a source of hypotheses, and then we proceeded to test implications of those hypotheses or the hypotheses themselves by bringing to bear data. And, of course, sometimes this bringing to bear data involved fairly complicated econometric exercises. And the so-called new economic history, or cleometrics, was the use of reasonably advanced methods of statistical inference and econometrics to carry out these tests. And what we're doing there, as mainstream economists always purport to be doing, is testing economic theory. Because in the mainstream, economic theory is always up for grabs. It's like virtually arbitrary. If we wanted to go back to the kind of philosophical foundations of people like Karl Popper, we would say it's just conjectures. It's just a bunch of sort of things that may or may not be true, and then we go find out. And the testing is the finding out. That's what applied economists spend their time doing. And if the data don't fit the theoretical expectations, then what we're supposed to do is adjust the theory. We're supposed to go back and throw out the part that makes it predict inaccurately and keep going back and forth. There's supposed to be an interplay between the way the theory is specified and the way the data do or do not match up with the theoretical implications. And I had a career like that for some time when I started out, and I was having pretty good luck as a mainstream economist. And then I started learning more and more about Austrian economics and couldn't stand that success anymore. So that was the end of that. So there's a lesson there too. In the Austrians' case, one studies history almost like an old-fashioned historian in a way. It's not that you don't use data. You certainly do use data. And if you've looked at anything like Rothbard's book on the Great Depression, it's filled with data. It takes careful account of different ways of measuring economic variables, and it certainly is not sitting in an armchair with the eyes closed imagining one can arrive at conclusions about historical reality. And on the abstract level, the distinction here is between theory or praxeology and what Mises called thymology, which is a word that is so rare that perhaps Mises invented it. I'm not really sure, but if you know Greek and Latin and so forth, you can be very inventive about about the invention of new terms that are just right for those people who know Greek and Latin. But if you're like me, I'm from Oklahoma and we don't speak no Greek. even in Greek restaurants, they talk like Okies. But nonetheless, thymology is the study of historical reality in all its peculiarities. in all the distinctions that apply to particular times and places and people. So that what we're doing there is taking economic theory, which is universally applicable to everybody at all times and places. It's logical. It's all derived from the action axiom. It can't be wrong unless we've made a logical mistake in deriving some implications. But the question is, how do we use that theory and put it into the context of specific events and occurrences and choices that actual human beings are making, and get a richer picture of the empirical reality, not just the logical structure of what they're doing and what its consequences were, but of the actual empirical course that they traced out and the actual empirical consequences of that. A lot of Austrian economic theory is, as it were, it's quantity free. Okay? It's qualitative relationships. So that when you derive the law of demand in Austrian economics, it just says other things equal, if the price of some good rises, the quantity demanded will be less. But it doesn't say how much less. And in empirical reality, sometimes when the law of demand operates, what we see is a great elasticity of demand, and at other times, very little elasticity of demand. It's always the case that there's an inverse relationship between price and quantity demanded, other things held fixed. But in empirical reality, we're often unsure. In fact, we're generally unsure what other things were not held fixed, because the world is constantly changing in all sorts of ways that may affect a particular market relationship. Okay? It doesn't invalidate the law of demand, because that's a law that applies strictly, other things being equal. See, now, if you were a mainstream economic historian, you would try to get around that issue, which you would recognize, but you would try to get around it by controls in your econometric procedures. So you would not just relate quantity demanded and price of a good, but you would put in a lot of other variables like income and what have you, that you would try to econometrically hold fixed so you could find out the partial relationship between price and quantity demanded, controlling for those other things that may affect quantity demanded also. Unfortunately, for positivists who insist this is the only way to go about things, you can never know or be sure that you've made all the right controls. Never. There's even a theorem in the philosophy of science that says you can't do it. Duhem's theorem. Okay? You can't do it. Not only can you not do it in economics, you can't do it in any science. So if you're doing laboratory experiments in physics, okay, and you're looking for some relationship between pressure and some variable, but you said, well, I got to measure this holding temperature fixed. Well, that may be so, but there may be other things you got to hold fixed too. So you can do experiments in which you experimentally hold other things fixed, but only the things you know to hold fixed. And you can never know which things those are. They might be so many that you'll never know what they are. And so your theory will continue in some way to be imperfect, even though it has perhaps a high predictive capability in certain kinds of applications. So in Austrian economics, in a sense, we don't worry about that because we're not making any claims about elasticities of demand other than their sign. Okay? The sign of price elasticity of demand is negative. For the Austrians, the income elasticity is positive. Okay, fine. But that is not enough to allow us to retell the story of, say, the Great Depression. It's one thing to have an Austrian business cycle theory that tells us that if you distort interest rates, you're inevitably going to have a bust. Okay? But that doesn't tell us how big a bust. That's not going to tell us when the bust occurs. How much will the price level fall, if at all? It's not going to tell us anything about how much real income will fall. It's not going to tell us any of these how much questions. That won't answer that, because Austrian theory doesn't purport to have the power to do that. nor should it make the claim to have that power. But mainstream economic history is always looking for a greater ability to tell those how much stories correctly. Okay? And for Austrians, they just kind of sadly shake their heads and say, well, keep looking. Keep looking. Every time somebody cooks up a new specification of econometric model, you're probably going to get a different answer to your question about how much the effect of certain relationships was. Okay. So that's kind of a general background that lies behind any attempt to do Austrian economic history. I think I started doing it without knowing I was doing it. I blended from being a mainstream economic historian as I learned more Austrian economics over a long period of time into doing it more like an Austrian. Murray Rothbard actually told me one time I was doing Austrian economic history, and I said, oh, who knew? he did. But I eventually came to understand what he was telling me. But it's a subtle and it's a difficult thing, and it's hard to explain to a neoclassical economist. It took me years and years to understand Austrian economics. So if you're having a little trouble with it somehow, don't think it's you. It's hard. The epistemological foundation is the hard part. The rest of it's not so hard, but that's essential, and that's what it took me a long time to understand, is you've got to get that straight, or you're never going to really understand the difference between what the mainstream teaches and what the Austrians teach. Okay. Well, I want to today use World War II as a kind of illustration of issues that arise in doing economic history, and doing it in some ways, whether you're a mainstream economic historian or an Austrian, but in certain respects, only an Austrian will see particular issues as problematic. And I want to dwell on some of those as I go along. I can get my gizmo right here. The story that has come down to us about World War II is one that you can put in a sentence, and many people have put it in a sentence. They say World War II got the economy out of the Depression. Okay, there you have it. A few years ago, a fellow teaches over at North Carolina Greensboro put together a book in which he went out and he got a bunch of older economists, eminent economists. Several of them were Nobel Prize winners in economics. And he asked them a number of questions about their careers and about how the profession had developed over time. And one of the questions he asked them was, what got the U.S. economy out of the Great Depression? And virtually every one of them, more or less, said World War II got the economy out of the Depression. And that was true not only of Keynesians like Tobin and Samuelson, it was equally true of Milton Friedman and other monitors that were in the group. They all agreed. They didn't all agree on the mechanics. The monitors tend to focus on the fact that during the war, the Fed had generated huge increases every year in the stock of money. I mean, for 3 or 4 years, the money stock was increased 20% a year or in that range, which had never been done before and hasn't been done since, but during the war it was, and so the monitors thought, well, that's it. You know, the monitors always think that the money stock is the tail that wags all dogs. So whatever you do, it's like, oh, magic. The rest of the world falls into line with what's happened to the money stock. And, of course, the Keynesians and the post-Keynesians and the neo-Keynesians and the halfway Keynesians, they all thought that vast government spending during the war was what turned the trick. You know, you can have this story retold virtually every week by Paul Krugman in his New York Times column. He's still not got beyond Keynesianism circa 1939. You know, that's basically the level at which he expounds it in his newspaper columns. So if the government spends a lot of money, any depression that you have will be cured. If it's not cured, spend more money. That's all there is to it. Doesn't matter what you spend it for. So he's perfectly aware. He sometimes notes that what he calls this great public works program, that's his way of describing World War II, this great public works program, sure, it was horrible. We built a lot of weapons and means of war, and then we went out and killed people and destroyed property. But you know, that was just the form that the spending took, and because the spending was there, the economy recovered. There were multiplier effects on the civilian economy. So everybody was better off. During the war, there was this wartime prosperity. Now, when people actually try to flesh out the story of how the economy got, how the war got the economy out of depression, they focus on three main things. And the first one is what happened to unemployment. Okay? Now, you'll see here that as late as 1940, the standard unemployment rate is still very high. It's almost 16%. That old Bureau of Labor Statistics definition of unemployment counted as unemployed several million people who were employed by the government in emergency work relief programs, most of them in something called the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. By that time called the Works Projects Administration. For some reason, they changed the name in the late 30s. But at all events, they were counted by an old friend of mine, Stanley Liebergott, who made those estimates back in the 1940s for the first time. See, during the Depression, nobody knew what the rate of unemployment was. They just guessed because it was not systematically estimated by any kind of data collection method. But Liebergott came up with these numbers, and he found that he didn't want to count these emergency government workers as employed because these weren't regular, real jobs. He said, you know, this would be faking if we threw these people in. Well, I'm of two minds about it. Yes and no. It's kind of faking, but at the same time, they weren't outright unemployed either. They were going off to work. They were doing things and getting paid by the government. So they certainly, if you look at an individual basis, these individuals employed by the WPA were not like a guy who simply has no job and no earnings. So there were differences, and what I've done is I've just looked at both series to see what happens. And what happens here in the early 40s is that they disappear because emergency work relief jobs disappear as people move either in the armed forces or into real jobs. Somewhere, either in the private sector or in the government, civilian employment, in permanent-type government jobs, not emergency relief jobs. Okay? But what happens here, you see, in a few years, the unemployment rate falls from these depression levels down to, in fact, at the peak of the war, the lowest measured unemployment rates ever. Okay? A little over 1%. And in fact, everything you read about specific conditions during the war tells you that if you wanted a job, you could get a job like that. Just about anywhere you were in the country. Labor was so scarce that employers were beating the bushes to find people to work for them. And a lot of them just never could find as many people as they were willing to hire. So that meant that a lot of people who had never been in the paid labor force entered. A lot of women who had never worked, millions of women who had never worked in the paid labor force before, entered the labor force and got good jobs, got training to work in manufacturing plants, particularly in the aircraft industry. A lot of them worked, and all sorts of other jobs. So some women filled in, some teenagers who would have stayed in school normally joined the labor force, some old people who had left the labor force and gone into retirement came back into the labor force. So that made up for some of the losses from the labor force when men were withdrawn in large numbers into the armed forces. In September 1940, Congress passed a draft law and started conscripting men to serve in the U.S. Army. And after 1 year, it had conscripted about 700,000 men already, which was more than 1% is about 1.5% of the labor force in just that first year. And then they conscripted many more. At some time during the war, they conscripted a little over 10 million men. Now, remember, the labor force, when the war starts, the labor force, you can't see it here because it's in percentage terms, but the overall labor force of the United States was a little over 50 million. So think about that. 50 million in the labor force, and you draw out and put into the uniform military services almost 20% of them. And while you were drafting these people, you were creating a strong incentive for others to enlist. Because if you enlisted in the Navy, you knew one thing, and that is that you were never going to be in the infantry. And that's what people didn't want most of the time, because being in the infantry meant that in wartime, you had a better chance than almost anybody of being blown to pieces. And you also, even if you weren't killed or seriously injured, you lived like a dog. You know, you're out there living in holes in the ground with lice all over your body and no comforts and terrified to, because people are trying to kill you night and day in a combat zone. You'd be shelled all the time. And it wasn't like Iraq, where some guys may jump out and shoot at you or plant a bomb by the road. It was like gigantic artillery barrages would come down on your area and body parts would be flying everywhere. You're hoping, you know, yours won't be next. So the infantry was not good, and a lot of people joined the Navy or the Army Air Corps, as it was called at the beginning of the war, to try to stay out of the infantry. But, you know, you couldn't be sure. I mean, you could be sure you wouldn't live in a hole that way, but you couldn't be sure you would live, because some jobs in those other services were also very dangerous. A lot of naval personnel did get killed in the war, and the crews in the bomber airplanes that went over Europe dropping bombs were subject to very high mortality. So if you completed 20 or 25 missions over Europe in a B-17, you had to count yourself extraordinarily lucky. I have a good friend, Dick Timberlake. I'm sure Joe knows him. Dick was a young man. I think he was only about early 20s at the time. And he was a pilot in a B-17, and he did a whole bunch of missions over Europe dropping bombs, but lived to tell about it, as many people didn't. Okay, so you're either drafting or you're frightening a lot of men in the armed forces, and at one time or another, about 16 million men and some women, you know, several hundred thousand women, served in the armed forces. Now remember, we started out with the labor force a little over 50. Well, now ask yourself, in this situation, what's going to happen to unemployment? How can you have any unemployment in this condition? You've sucked people out of the labor force right and left. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Keynesian, a monetarist, or you believe in animal spirits or sunspots or whatever. It's irrelevant. You don't need economic theory to tell you you're going to get rid of unemployment if the government comes along and forces or creates a strong incentive for people to enter the armed forces. That's what happened. Now, when you talk to people who lived through that period, they agree. The war got the economy out of the Depression. And what do they mean? They mean that unemployment disappeared. They either lacked work in the 30s themselves, or they lived in fear of being unemployed. And now those things are just not factors in their lives anymore. Not only can anybody who wants a job get a job, but they can get paid in money terms better than most of them had ever been paid before. The money wage was really good, particularly in war plants during the war. The people that worked in aircraft factories, ammunition factories, they got a wage rate that was considerably above comparable people working in civilian production during the war. So, hell yes, life is good. This is wartime prosperity. Now, it's true, of course, that a lot of things they wanted to buy with their earnings, they couldn't, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but they still felt they were in pretty good shape as by virtue of having a steady job, reliable employment, and high wage rates. Now, if you think about what this means, not just for the average Joe in the labor force, no offense, Joe, but for the workings of the overall economy, what are we looking at here? And I've kind of broken it down into a few categories to show you. Before the war, the problem for the overall economy is that we've got this huge proportion of it that's just not producing anything. They're out of work. They're unemployed. They're not contributing labor services to the production of wealth. Okay, we've got a few people, less than 2%, who are either in the armed forces or in some plant making goods and services for the armed forces. And then we've got over 82% of the labor force that's in non-defense employment, producing things that consumers value directly or indirectly. And that's the way the economy is making use of the available labor force. Okay, now what happens? Well, look over here. Of course, as I was saying, defense employment shoots up to an incredible amount. About 40% of the whole labor force, including armed forces in this labor force measure, is working for the peak years of the war, either in the armed forces or in military supply industries. 40%. Okay? If you did that today, that would be what, like putting 50 million people in the armed forces or defense plants. Can you imagine that? 50 million people? It's inconceivable. Well, it was inconceivable then, too, in a way. This was a kind of enormous experience that was a one-time thing in American economic history. This hadn't happened at all to this degree in previous wars, and it hasn't happened since World War II either. So this was a militarized economy. And what you see over here, kind of the other side of this, is that the people in non-defense employment are shrinking as a share of the whole, down to less than 60% of the whole. And that tells you something that you kind of begin to suspect, well, could this have really been a great time for consumers? When there's been such a great shrinkage in the proportion of the labor force engaged in producing things that consumers want? Yeah. And the answer is no, it wasn't a great time for consumers, despite what some misleading data show. Okay, I constructed this thing I call the residuum there, which is just adding up defense plus unemployment, because in a sense, these are all the people as a percent of the labor force that are not here. Okay? And it's the residuum is like, in a sense, waste employment. Now, it's true that exerting military force may have some benefits. People may perceive it to be beneficial in a sense. But even if they do, we have no way to know how much it's worth to them. And I'll come back to that point too. Because an Austrian would see right away, when there's no market, you can't know the value of what is being produced or exchanged. You just can't do it. Markets are what generate that piece of information. And here, when you're turning the economy over to militarization, a kind of bureaucratic control from the top down, you're destroying markets or distorting markets so that these data no longer have the meaning they normally would mean. Okay? So another way that economists think there was a wartime prosperity was that real output shot up. There was this so-called miracle of production. And I've put up here a number of variants of measures of real GNP. I didn't use GDP because I collected these before the switch was generally made, but it doesn't matter because GNP and GDP are almost identical in this period. Okay? It won't matter. And so one of the things I want to show you with all these numbers is that GDP or GNP is not really a properly scientific variable. This is like the heart and soul of macroeconomics, as it's taught in every mainstream school in the world, for that matter. It's like you build a macro model and you have production functions like Q is a function of K and L, okay? Q being output, empirically meaning GDP, L, total labor force, K, total labor services provided by the stock of capital. You have these simple relationships like that, but what you're trying to explain at the bottom of all macroeconomics in modern terms in the last 60, 70 years is what happens to Q, real output. So what is Q? Well, how do you measure Q? We live in a world with millions of separate goods and services being produced. You got to somehow reduce them to a single number. Now, if I just told you, go out and do it, think about what you'd do. Where would you start to reduce everything that's going on productively in the U.S. economy, say, to a single number that would have information content that, you know, whose rise or fall would be something that had a meaning, a real meaning? That's what national income and product accounting purports to do. Right? And so that you start out by defining GDP as the value at market prices of all final goods and services produced in the economy in some period, usually a year. Okay? Well, there's some critical elements in that definition. One is all goods and services. So there's a question of how you define the goods and services that ought to be taken into account here. Which things should be left out? If I go out and walk my dog, am I producing a service that should be valued and its value included in GDP? If not, why not? Why is it that when I hire somebody to watch my dog and pay them to walk my dog, the payments I make to the dog kennel do go into GDP? It's the same service in both cases, but one gets included in the measure and one doesn't. Odd, isn't it? Well, that same kind of oddity pervades these data. There used to be this kind of joke that went around about a man marries his housekeeper, you know, and GDP goes down because, you know, she becomes a housewife. She doesn't get a market wage anymore. She's still keeping house the same as before. And it's full of that kind of stuff. One of the difficulties for historians is as you go back in time, a lot of output, and even today in many parts of the world, a lot of output doesn't pass through markets. It's the product of peasants or people who produce food for themselves or other goods for themselves, who do work for themselves. Historically, in the United States, farmers would typically create a lot of capital by going out and clearing forests or other obstructions to agriculture, and then they would create cultivable land, and they would build fences. They would do all this without any markets getting involved. Okay? They would use local materials. They would provide their own labor. Well, various economic historians eventually decided they needed to take into account the amount of capital accumulation that was being undertaken in this way by people building productive structures and equipment and land areas and draining land, fencing land, you name it, all these things that made a raw natural resource that basically was worth zero into something that was a valuable source of an income stream that turned it, they turned it into capital. Okay? But when you make an estimate of national product, you have, you know, what should be included, okay? And that issue comes up in another form when you say, okay, the value at market prices, stop, at market prices, okay? Well, suppose there's some service that you agree belongs in national product but doesn't have a market price. Like these I've been talking about. They didn't have a market price. You didn't say, what was, if the farmer had gone out and hired somebody to fence his land, okay, we would know he paid so much for a fence. But when he builds it himself, what is its value? Should we value it according to the amount he would have paid someone to put it there? Maybe, but maybe not. Eh? There has to be an argument behind that answer to the question as well. So whenever we don't have market prices, we're kind of in a quandary. Should we estimate them? Should we leave this good or service out of the calculation? And this question comes up repeatedly. In not too distant past, the statisticians decided that they needed to impute a value to owner-occupied housing. As they said, well, if I were renting my home, I would pay a certain amount to acquire its services. Okay, I own it. I'm living there. I'm not paying anything for it, but there are still services being rendered by the house. So they concocted an econometric model to impute value to owner-occupied housing, and that now goes into GDP, but only because it's such a big item that was being left out, not because it's the only such item. It isn't by any means. So this is especially important here during wartime because the government takes control of about 40% of the economy. If you take seriously the value in the GDP accounts of government purchases of goods and services. That's the way government's contribution to national output is defined and measured. Okay? So if government hires workers, what it pays them is a contribution to GDP. If it hires soldiers, same thing. If it buys a B-29 bomber, okay, how much did it pay the Boeing company for that airplane? That goes into GDP. Okay? Now, the reason that we define GDP as using market prices is because market prices sort of approximate something that has a meaning. They sort of approximate trade-offs that consumers are making when they adjust their purchases of different goods and services. We think of them as making decisions at the margin about buy more of this, buy a little less of that, allocate their expenditures across all the opportunities they have in such a way that the payoff, as it were, the utility, the marginal utility of the last dollar spent in each kind of expenditure is the same. Otherwise, they could reallocate their spending and be better off. Okay? Now, that's what the situation would be in full consumer equilibrium. Okay? Where every consumer had made all these adjustments and the whole economy, in turn, had been adjusted just so that it supplied just the amounts that match up with every consumer's having reached full allocational equilibrium. Okay? Now, we don't really need to say that that situation never exists. You know, long before such an equilibrium could be reached, something changes and people start making adjustments, buying less of this, more of that. New goods and services are always coming onto the market from entrepreneurs. Old goods are disappearing. All kinds of things are happening, including the people who compose the economy are themselves changing. Some of them die every day. New ones are born. Okay? Some move in. Some move out. And yet in national income accounting, we're kind of maintaining the fiction that we're always in full consumer equilibrium at every moment when we go out and measure prices in the markets of, you know, the day we take our samples. Well, that's not the worst assumption in you can imagine, because if there really are markets in which people are free to make adjustments and enter and exit and alter consumption patterns, at least we can suppose that people are working toward that kind of equilibrium. So that if we see, you know, a loaf of bread costs a dollar and a pair of shoes costs $2, we can think that, well, at the margin, people are willing to trade two loaves of bread for one pair of shoes and vice versa. You know, that's their trade-off that they're willing to make. That's their expression of their valuations. And that's what we're trying to get. Now, during war, if we have 40% of the economy consisting not of free market purchases, but of government purchases, including a lot of being purchases in quote marks because it's payments made to soldiers that were forced into the armed forces against their will. You know, they could have declined if they'd been willing to go to prison. Okay? They're forced into the armed forces, or they're strongly induced there by the threat of draft or imprisonment. So they show up and they just take what they're given. You know, they don't bargain for wages. They don't say, oh yeah, the military wage is not quite good enough, so some of them leave. That's called desertion in wartime. And, you know, if worse comes to worse, you'll be shot for desertion. So these aren't anything like market wage rates for services of soldiers. They're just totally divorced from it. Now, what about the goods that government buys? What about the B-29 that the War Department bought from the Boeing company? Is that a market price? Looks kind of like it. Here's this corporation's got a product, and here's a buyer. But notice, first of all, it's just one buyer. It's the only buyer of B-29s because, you know, even if somebody else wanted to buy it, the government wouldn't permit it. It sort of controls war production. It says who can get access to what war goods for what purposes. And it says only we, the government of the United States, can have B-29 bombers. So it's one guy from the War Department, or one small group of guys from the War Department. They sit down with a guy or a small group of guys from the Boeing company, and they talk about this. Boeing says, oh, you know, we'd like $1 billion each. And the War Department guy says, no can do. You're dreaming. And then they proceed from there. And they talk. And they bargain and they dicker and go back and forth. And finally they settle. And when they settle, that settlement hinges very much on the fact that the guys at the War Department are not spending their own money, but they have incentives, because in their particular job, what they're trying to do is add this weapon, the B-29, to the arsenal that the Army Air Forces, that's what they're called by this time, are going to use for certain military missions. And they want that bomber as fast as they can get it. They really are much more concerned about getting it soon than they are about how much they pay the Boeing company. So for a whole lot of reasons, the price they ultimately agree on and actually pay is not an economic measure of anything. It's produced by a non-economic consumer interacting with a highly constrained producer, using other people's money to make a transaction. There's just nothing here that allows us to say this somehow approximates a market value. It's arbitrary. Okay? It's arbitrary. So that's one of the reasons why, if you look at different estimates, it's only one of the reasons, but that's one of the reasons why different estimates of what happened to real output during the war are so different. And I mean very different in some cases. Very different. Okay. Because Kuznets in particular didn't want to include every dollar the government spent for war in total output. And he was the main American contributor to the development of the national income and product accounts. So he was an important guy here. And if Kuznets had an objection, then that was something people would listen to. He ultimately gave up on this, by the way. For a decade or more, he made his own estimates of national output. And then the Commerce Department got so enormous and had so many more resources than he could accumulate. He was almost like a one-man statistician for a long time. That he could no longer compete. And so he sort of gave up trying to use his own concepts of national output and its components and allow the Commerce Department to do it. Now, during the war, this whole business of should government be included in GDP or not, that had been a very lively issue before the war. Many people, including Kuznets, said, no, it shouldn't. Government spending is different. It doesn't have a market basis. Shouldn't be in there. And then during the war, Kuznets changed his mind a little bit. He says certain kinds of military spending should be in there, but not all. And he thought, for example, that the government military capital formation should be kept in there because after a war was over, this capital would still be there and could be put to civilian uses. Well, that sounds good in the abstract until you look at the actual capital that the military constructed. It wasn't like factories and runways for airplanes. The overwhelming part of it, I'll have some data in a minute to show you, was weapons platforms. It was ships, warships, military aircraft, of which 300,000 were manufactured during the war. Think of that. The military-industrial complex would be lucky to manufacture 30 warplanes a year now. But they manufactured 300,000 airplanes during the war. They built all kinds of things that are of use to nobody except the military. Gunnery ranges, bombing ranges, barracks. That's true. Some of the stuff that they created, like trucks, could be used for non-military purposes. So there was an argument along Kuznets lines for including that capital formation. But it's a relatively quite small part of the total. Okay? But the point here, my point is that first of all, there's a great variation in how you can build these numbers, so don't ever take them as some kind of precision measures. These are not like data used in chemistry and physics at all. Okay? They're a different kind of data. Now, one of the things I did over here for my purpose, I created this thing I call GNP star, which is a GNP with all the military spending taken out of it. Just military, not all government, but during the war, the great bulk of government spending was military spending, about 90% or so. So if you take out the military spending, what happens to GNP? Well, first of all, you see here, it's growing before the U.S. gets involved in the war all out in 1941. Okay? It's already come up about 19% in just 2 years' time. So finally, the economy is getting out of the depression. But these numbers are becoming iffy in 1941 because we're already starting to increase military outputs, which means we're already starting to put arbitrary numbers into these calculations. Okay? Now what happens? The non-military part falls drastically, you know, falls by about 10% here in 1 year. It falls again by a little less in 1943, and then it increases a little bit. In 1945, you know, the war in Europe ended in May, the war in Japan ended in August. So part of 1945 is a non-war year, and we're starting to get more civilian production. But even look, in 1945, after the economy's been at war for these 4 years, where are we? We're way below where we were in 1941 in terms of the non-military economy. Where's the war prosperity? There's no war prosperity. It's just producing a lot of damn weapons and ammunition and things that go with weapons and ammunition. That's all. Okay? Now, that's always been something that the mainstream interpretation of the war also disputes, because it says, look, okay, we all know that there was this huge number of airplanes and tanks and military outputs produced during the war, but consumers were better off too. Hey, we had guns and butter. One historian wrote that it was a carnival of consumption. Imagine that, a carnival of consumption. Yeah. Party down, dude. So what happens? Where'd they get the idea that it was a carnival of consumption? Well, part of it they just got from historians' anecdotes. So it's not systematically based at all. But the economists didn't rely on anecdotes. They relied on data, and they relied on these data. And what you do is you go to the national income and product accounts, and they're divided in one way between consumer spending, investor spending, government spending, and net exports. That's our standard breakout there. So they go to the consumer spending part of GDP accounts, and they say, okay, we'll use those, but you know, there's some price level changes going on, so we have to adjust to find out what's happening to real consumption. So they do that, And what do they use? Of course, they use the standard price indexes that are being produced by the government during the war. And when they get through making their deflation here, they get these data that purport to show, like let's take this Commerce Department estimate from 1990. Consumers are really getting better off here. This is kind of tracking what I showed you a minute ago about the increase in real output, okay, including real non-military output. So far, so good up to 1941. But now what happens? Well, it stalls here, and then it comes up a little bit and a little bit more. In 1945, it looks as if we've come up to 123 from like 110 in the last year before the all-out war. And that looks like, yeah, they're not doing so great, but people are getting better off. Consumers are getting better off in real terms. And if you look at the other series produced by other people, John Kendrick and Simon Kuznets, they work closely. They wrote huge, gigantic books for the National Bureau of Economic Research. And I actually recommend these things if you're a glutton for punishment like me. Plow through them, because what you learn about how they made their estimates is an education in itself. And you'll never be the same kind of economist again after you read those, because then you'll know what you're talking about. And most of the guys who say teach macroeconomics go around talking about real output. They don't have any idea how these data are arrived at. But in this case, what we see is a pretty high degree of agreement. Unlike the data I showed you a minute ago on total output, the real consumer data look as if, yeah, consumers get a little better off even during the war years. Okay? Well, let's go back and think about how we constructed these figures. Remember, we had to deflate the nominal spending for consumer goods by a price index, and we used the government's measured price index that the Bureau of Labor Statistics put together during the war in the usual way. And they have this big, large number of people that go out and they collect prices. They actually go in the grocery store and say, you know, 12-ounce can of peas, what's the price? And they just go through the store and they collect prices on a kind of set of goods that are defined as the market basket for purposes of the consumer price index. All right. Well, what's the problem? The problem is that during the war, the government immediately starts controlling prices. It does it sort of informally and by intimidation as early as 1940 and a lot more in 1941. And then in 1942, it develops really serious price control laws with a huge enforcement bureaucracy called the Office of Price Administration that had literally hundreds of thousands of people working for it, either collecting price data or enforcing price control laws. And they would go out snooping around and find, you know, somebody's violating, you know, he's control price says you can't charge more than 20 cents for this can of peas, and you're charging 22 cents, and they charge you with a violation, and some people are ultimately prosecuted and put in prison. Generally, they just intimidated people and made them change what they were doing or fine them, but some people were imprisoned. You know, you always need to make an extreme example of some people. Okay? So that's what's going on. There's sort of across-the-board price control in the civilian economy. Remember, the rest of the economy, the military economy, is all arbitrary prices. So you can forget that. But that's not in here. This is just the civilian economy. These prices, however, are arbitrary in their own way, because you're going out and trying to find the actual prices that people are paying. And in a way, you are, except for the many black markets that developed with different prices, okay, higher prices there. But nonetheless, people are paying these prices, but they're not telling you the same thing that prices normally tell you. They're not telling you that people have adjusted at the margin across all kinds of spending until the marginal utility of each dollar spent is the same everywhere they spend it. These markets are in disequilibrium. By and large, these markets are massively in a situation of excess demand. These are all markets that would have higher prices if They could legally set higher prices if the sellers could, but they don't because they don't want to be fined or imprisoned. Okay? So we've got a bunch of prices that are being measured. They're too low. The actual prices, we know, were higher. We don't know exactly how much higher, and that's caused a lot of work by econometricians to try to estimate how much higher should the price index have told us prices were in general. And there's no certain answer to that because it just can't be found with econometrics. But what we know here is that these are bogus. When they tell us consumers were better off during the war, well, if they were, they were not that much better off. Okay? And so let's say, well, how much better off, if any, were they? And that's where I looked at some of these attempts to estimate what really happened to the price level during the war years rather than what was reported. Okay? Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz have a book, not their Great Monetary History, a different book about prices in the United States and the UK. It's another great National Bureau of Economic Research book that's full of data on prices. And in that book, they made an attempt to estimate what the actual price level was for net national product during the war. And so that's what they find. And you can see several things right away. For one thing, their deflator shows you that during the war itself, prices go up to about 57% more than they were in 1939. That's a great deal more than the official price index tells you had happened by that time. Now, another thing, if you look at the official price index, it makes it look as if there was a big spurt of inflation at the end of the war, 1946-47. But Friedman and Schwartz tell you what happened in 1946. Well, basically nothing. A little more in 47, but nothing like this huge spike that you see in the official price index. And what are you seeing there? In the official index, you're seeing the fact that the price controls were taken off at the end of the war. So now sellers could set prices at something like the level that cleared the market. It's a revelation of inflation. It's not actual inflation. During the war, the inflation had expressed itself in different forms. The cost to consumers of acquiring goods had gone up because, not because the money cost had gone up so much, except in the black markets, but because they had to wait in lines a long time to buy things. They had to search, had to spend time looking around for sellers that had a certain good and would sell it to them. They had to arrange trades, not only of goods, but of ration tickets, because scores of goods were rationed. So besides the money, you had to have a prescribed number of ration coupons to buy these goods. So this is a very inefficient system where people are actually bearing costs to get goods and services, but those costs are taking different forms than money out of the pocket. Okay? And that's the sense in which when the price controls came off, now consumers' costs are taking monetary form again. The sellers have just raised prices to clear markets. And, of course, for Friedman and Schwartz, not using the official price index, there is no spurt at the end of the war to speak of. Okay, so that's still not a perfect price index, I guarantee you. There are a lot of things still wrong with it, and they admit that there are a lot of things still wrong with it they couldn't fix. But if I use this one instead of the official price index, then I get this measure of real consumption per capita here. And what does it show? Well, once again, 1940 and 41, consumers are doing fine. Things are getting better. And there's really no argument that those 2 years were generally improving ones for the whole economy. It's what happens afterwards. And by this measure, what happens in 42 is a substantial drop in real personal consumption per capita. A further drop sticks there. It comes back up a little bit in 45 when we're starting to get rid of these controls. But look, even in 45, we still aren't back to the level of 1941. Where's the wartime prosperity? There is none. And I guarantee it was worse than this because this index is still incomplete. So as we walk through all the standard measures by which economists have concluded there was wartime prosperity and it ended the Great Depression, we realize what a phony argument this is. It doesn't hold water, even on mainstream terms. When I started writing about this in the 1990s for journals, there wasn't anything especially Austrian about most of what I wrote. It was something any economic historian should have to listen to. But they hadn't, and nor did macroeconomists. And the macroeconomists still haven't listened to it. You can get some of the top macro guys in the mainstream, and they're still taking seriously the bogus data about World War II. And I'm frankly just baffled by it. Now, here's the standard story of GDP growth. And what you see here is this enormous wartime bulge, this big miracle of production. And then you see in 1946, the most depressed year in American history. Just, you know, if you know any old people, ask them. Remember 1946? Wasn't that a horrible year? And they'll say, huh? What are you talking about, youngster? Because it wasn't anything like a horrible year. It was actually like a great year. In fact, I think it was the greatest year ever in one year for the American economy. But these official data, now these are the same data, okay, that your economist argues wartime prosperity. Well, if that's wartime prosperity and it's real, this is post-war depression and it's real. But they all know that's not real. And they don't try to even claim it is because it's so stupid. Okay? So they say, well, yeah, that was just an artifact of, you know, reconversion and putting the economy back on a civilian basis and so forth. But that was the artifact on the other side. Okay? What goes up comes down conceptually in exactly the same way. Now, if you look instead at private part of gross domestic product, you get a totally different profile. Now, if you're looking back at the 30s, the profile of private GDP and total GDP is much the same. They don't really deviate that much, despite these government programs that the New Deal put into effect. They're basically the same ups and downs, okay? But starting in 1942, you get a completely different story here for the next 5 years. You get, for the private economy, that 1942 is a really bad year, because guns are taking resources away from butter, to a more than 10% drop in the private part of GDP. And then another drop, of lesser magnitude, maybe 4% here in 1943. You get a little makeup in 44 and 45, but you put that all together, and what you find is that the private economy is sort of awash during World War II, even by these data, which are not good. You remember, I've been talking about other reasons that are problematic that these data don't take into account. But look at 1946. It looked like such a great depression on the previous chart. Now it looks like the greatest year ever. This comes much closer to telling us a true story than those previous data did. Because when you start doing GDP accounting, putting government into the picture, you're just starting to make all kinds of mistakes. And Austrian knows that better than anybody, because he knows that if you want market prices, you must have markets. If you don't have markets that are generating observed prices, those prices have no economic meaning. They're arbitrary to a greater or lesser degree. Now, here's the way I kind of put a lot of things together in one picture. The solid line at the top is your mainstream standard GDP. And this is real. It's in logs, so you can't read the magnitudes readily. But I did the logs for a reason. Here you see, you know, all the wartime shortfall below the growth line. And here you see this huge bulge above it. Now, if you've ever had any training in how to fit these growth trends, like this is a standard way, you fit business cycle peaks, and you say, well, you know, we know we got from 1929 to 1948, so we could have got there steadily if we had always used our resources in the meantime. We didn't, so that growth potential was not realized here in the 30s, and then according to this picture, We produce more than our production capacity in the wartime. And you might shake your head and say, how can you produce more than your capacity? Isn't that odd? See, because normally you never rise above your growth trend line. If you do, it's just a small deviation representing some kind of measurement mistakes. But here you've got the gigantic increase above what purports to be your production potential. What's going on? Well, several things are going on. One, it's conceivable that like the labor force worked more hours than it normally would have worked in a growing economy. And in a way, that's true. The people in the non-military labor force did work longer work weeks during the war. But it's not enough to give you these numbers. Another thing that Mises talks about in various places is that war brings into play the consumption of capital. Okay? Normally, in a growing economy, you would be making provision as you went along for the wear and tear and obsolescence of the capital stock. Any going concern has to do that, has to set aside funds every year sufficient to replace worn-out equipment and make repairs on buildings and what have you. And that's just in order to keep its capital stock fixed so that it continue to produce the same amount of output there. Okay? Well, during wartime, what may happen and what did happen is you actually eat up capital stock. And the principal form this took during World War II was that physical capital like factory buildings and machinery was operated two or three shifts a day instead of one. So every hour you operate that stuff, it's wearing out, okay? Just the same as any other hour. Like the railroad rolling stock, for example, was used at about double the usual rate during the war. Railroads were overtaxed by military demand to move around goods and weapons and personnel. So they were using these railroad cars that normally should have been replaced. And they weren't replacing them. They were just continuing to use them as long as they could, wearing them out. And same with the stock of trucks, taxi cabs in all the cities in the United States were not replaced. Because during the war, the government shut down the production of civilian automobiles completely, the beginning of 1942. And it didn't allow a resumption of production of civilian cars until late 1945. It took a year or more before the factories converted back to making civilian vehicles rather than making airplanes or tanks or something else for the military. So you've got a long period there in which these forms of capital are just being worn out, used up. And during the war, you couldn't even make the usual repairs on your capital stock. The housing stock, for example, deteriorated quite badly because the government wouldn't even allow people to buy lumber to make repairs on homes or apartment buildings. They wanted the lumber to build barracks and to build other military facilities. So even things like cement and lumber were taken away from the civilian economy, and that compelled the civilian economy to make do with the existing capital stock as long as it could. And the result was a great eating up of capital during the war. Okay, now that'll help you to explain some of this output surge that seems to be going above potential, but not all of it. It's not enough. Okay, it's just not enough quantitatively. I wrote one article in a series here in which I tried to find out what was happening to the capital stock during the war, because a kind of subsidiary part of the mainstream explanation is that the war economy was great not only because it got the economy out of depression, but it also led the government to invest in all this new capital. Isn't that great? It built these new factories and shipyards and equipment that it bought at its own expense and put into private plants in many cases, in most cases, in fact. And so, isn't that great? After the war was over, we had all this capital that we could now use to produce civilian goods and services. No wonder the post-war economy was so prosperous. Okay? Well, there are lots of ways to measure this activity of government's investment during the war, but one of the things I want to call to your attention, because we're out of time, is that the overwhelming bulk of this was not in industrial facilities like factory buildings or shipyards, and not even in military facilities like gunnery ranges or airports or anything like that. It was in what's called national defense equipment. And what does that mean? You go look it up, get into the data and say, what is this national defense equipment? It's weapons platforms. It's warships, warplanes, tanks, artillery pieces. It's the stuff that armies use, okay? What good is this when the war's over? It's no good. It's practically all worthless. And even when they took military output at the end of the war and tried to auction it off, because there were mountains of this stuff, you know, it was all over the place. They built so much during the war. And 1945 comes, the war ends, and then you like millions of military trucks. I grew up on a big ranch where we used some of these things that had been bought for about 1% of their initial selling price. And we even had a half track vehicle, you know, with like tank tracks on the back and tires on the front. And we had all this stuff because the ranch had bought this for practically nothing. The military is just almost giving it away. And the same with these factories they built and a lot of the machine tools and other things they equipped them with. They had virtually no value for civilian purposes. That's why when they held auctions after the war, they were lucky to get 10% of what they had paid for this stuff to begin with. So this story of the government's great contribution to American growth by wartime investment, and a guy at Northwestern University named Bob Gordon has been a major pusher. He's a big-time macro guy. He's pushed this story for ages about the government's contribution to post-war prosperity by means of wartime investment. It's baloney. Bob never bothered to look at what this investment was in. And even Kuznets, God rest his soul, Kuznets didn't take seriously enough the fact that this government capital was not capital in the Austrian sense. For Austrians, capital is the value of a business plan, okay? Like a blueprint for how I'm going to run this enterprise. I'll need, you know, this much of a building and that much of a certain kind of equipment and this many hours of this kind of labor and put it all together and look how I'm going to use it over the period of its lifetime and replacement and what have you. And it has a certain present value. That's capital. If it has a positive present value, okay, it's a good thing. You know. If not, not. Okay? But capital is not something that's arrived at the way the Commerce Department arrives at it. The Commerce Department uses a thing called the perpetual inventory method. This is whenever a firm buys a piece of capital equipment or a new factory, it adds that amount to the capital stock. And then you use depreciation formulas, which are sort of arbitrary, every year to subtract an amount for depreciation from the total you've got. And so you got this inflow from investment, this outflow from depreciation and obsolescence, and you got this monetary value. And that's what I'm working with here, the Commerce Department's version of capital. But when I'm doing this, I got my fingers crossed behind me, you know, like telling my mama I didn't take that cookie. I don't know anything about it, Mama. Like these data, you have to cross your fingers to use them in the first place because that's not real capital in the Austrian sense. There was no business plan behind the government-owned, privately operated plants that the government built during the war. There was a wartime plan. Okay? The government had a plan, how many troops it wanted, where it wanted to take them, and what it wanted to do with them when they got there. And in order to carry out this technological plan, they then, you know, like good Soviets, they said, you know, we need this many ships of this type and this many factories for steel and this many for copper. And then they made the bureaucratic decisions accordingly, filtering right down the line to the firms that were carrying out the actual production. In most cases, the armed forces did some production. They made bombs and ammunition and what have you. But most of it was by civilian contractors, these so-called GOPO plants, government-owned, privately operated. So what we're doing here is sort of make-believe to begin with for an Austrian Well, there's a lot more I could tell you about this. I see some of you have my book, Depression, War, and Cold War, and in the first five chapters of that book, I go through more systematically the kinds of things I've been discussing with you here. But, you know, even if you never become an Austrian economist, you just go become an economist, period. First of all, may God have mercy on your soul. And secondly, these are good things to know. These are good things to know for a mainstream economist. If you want to be a decent economist, a decent economic historian, you can't do this shit. And this gets done, it gets done all the time. That's one of the reasons why mainstream economics is so bankrupt. It's like an open secret that they do all these wrong things, but it's like, oh, well, we all do it. Or that's the best we can do. Well, that's no basis for a science. That's make-believe. That's pretend science. You can't do even mainstream economics that way and hold your head up. Okay? So that's that.